Venerable Ajahn Gamona Singh, so when the monks speak with the lay people, they use the word jura and pawn, which means to grow in blessings. So we say, may you grow in blessings.
May you go in blessing.
So we see the value of all you gathering together like this on the screen. I see that there are many different generations on the screen here. Some older than myself, like the generation of my mother or father. Some just a bit older, like an older sibling. Others more similar age, like a close friend. Others younger, like a younger sibling. So we see the value of this gathering in this way, many different ages, many different generations. So there's a feeling I have, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but looking at the practitioners on the screen here, looks like more males than before. Usually it's a majority female, but on the screen now it looks like about half male, half female. So we shouldn't feel that this is strange or unusual, because it's not just females that suffer, but it's also males suffer as well. Monastics suffer, lay people suffer, laity on the five precepts suffer, lay people on the eight precepts suffer. And so we see all of us, different ages or walks of life, we gather to study the Dhamma of the fully self-awakened Buddha. Because we see that having been born in this world, all the different things we've experienced or done in our life thus far, whether it was right or wrong according to the level of our mindfulness and wisdom at the time, in the present we see the drawbacks in samsara. We see the drawbacks in the cycle of birth and death, being born and dying, born and dying. So whether we're male or female or whatever age we are, we have this experience of stress or suffering, have the contact with the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, the mind, like we've been taught. And these sense impressions come into the heart, and then this causes us to waver, to feel unstable. Whether we're wavering in terms of liking or an attraction, or wavering in terms of disliking, not wanting. And so this is a cause for us to experience these two different types of suffering. So therefore we see that in the Buddhasasana, the Buddhist dispensation, in the beginning we have a great deal of this stress and suffering, and so we seek to reduce it. And how do we do that? We do it through the method that we've been taught by the monks already. We have virtue, not to harm oneself, not to harm others. There's these two aspects. So we have virtue, and when we don't harm ourselves, we don't harm others, then our suffering reduces automatically. We see that if we lack virtue, for instance, if we drink alcohol, then we reduce our mindfulness and we go drive a car and get into an accident, and we can injure people or damage property, lose wealth. And if this happens and we don't have sufficient resources to handle the accident, then our relatives or family will come help, and that causes them to be troubled and agitated as well. And so we see that when we follow the precepts or have virtue, it reduces our suffering in a way that's not difficult to do. It reduces this coarse level of suffering to a high degree. So therefore, for us Dhamma practitioners, We practice this all the time, practice it continuously. That is to have virtue, to have the precepts. And we understand about this. We understand the details already as if we've been practicing for some time now. And it's something that we're able to do. And then the teacher teaches us that having virtue already, we're considered a Kalyanachana, a beautiful being. The mind is beautiful. And so we see that this is a good person, has virtue. But then the teacher still asks, well, do you still have suffering? And for myself as a monastic, I would answer, yes, I still have suffering, still have dukkha. I care for the precepts, but there's still suffering there. It's suffering on a subtler level. This coarse suffering from not having virtue, we understand already. But some people study this, and they see, well, I'm good already. Why do I still suffer? Other people that are not good, they come to hurt me, or they seem like they have more happiness and ease than me. Why is that? So this kind of doubt can arise for Dhamma practitioners. And therefore, we're taught to go like we are now on this retreat, to train the mind, to meditate, to bhavana. And this bhavana, it makes our mind better. We care for the mind to make the mind firm, stable, not to be weak or easily swayed, not to follow these worldly dhammas. And we understand these worldly dhammas have two sides. There's the side of gain, praise, pleasure, and fame. And there's the side of loss, criticism, pain, and disrepute. And so we make the mind firmly established. And we can ask, well, will we still meet with these eight worldly dhammas? Yes, we still meet with them. We're not able to run away from them, so we still experience them. Whatever country we're in, whatever group or society, anywhere in the world, we can't run away. Because having been born as a human is something we have to meet with. We care for this, for our virtue, and we make it so that the mind isn't swayed by these eight worldly dhammas. And the method to achieve that is meditation practice. So in the beginning of our meditation practice, we can feel like it's difficult. We've heard before that if one's a new practitioner, they don't yet know a lot. The method to use is patient endurance. So we come to meditate, to learn about our experience, things that we haven't observed before, like how are these moods of the mind, how are these sense objects. Maybe we have never looked at greed, aversion, or delusion in the mind. We've never watched it in our own minds. See, we don't yet know it, or we just know it a little bit. So we meditate, and then we see more clearly, and we see it more quickly as well as it arises. We see the agitation or heat from the defilements. And when sometimes we feel that we're not up for the task, we're not able to fight with it, and that's normal for new practitioners and old practitioners as well. And so therefore we're taught to have patient endurance. If we don't yet have a lot of knowledge, then don't worry about that. Just patiently endure with these sense impressions and moods. Then we can come and open the mind and heart to learn, to study. And we're taught by the great masters that we see the mind that's busy, thinking a lot, or annoyed. And the mind's agitated and hot, and so we patiently endure. And we also want or ask, well, how do we cure that mind state? And so we cultivate the opposite, which is the mind that's peaceful, the mind that's tranquil. So if we're proliferating a lot, thinking about this or that, here and there, very busy mind, getting lost in the moods and sense impressions, or feeling sad for a very long time, feeling anger for a long time. And these are things that bring our mind down. And so we find a way to bring the mind to peace and collectedness, to temporarily stop these moods. And we feel like, or to be able to do that is something very good. So we do it to rest the body and mind. So we have this, and then this gives rise to the ability to have some choice or some ability to choose in our life. So in the beginning, we're taught to watch the breath as it goes in and out. So with the in-breath, we see the beginning of the in-breath, how it stays for a little bit, and then it ceases. And then with the out-breath, we see the beginning of the out-breath as it arises, stays for a little while, and then ceases. And so we practice with that, and then we feel like it can be an easy object to recollect. It's in the body, and we can watch it at the nose, for instance, and we don't have to go out finding the breath or looking anywhere else for it, but it's just right here. And so we find that this is just a little thing, this is something little, but it's able to fix big problems. So if we have mindfulness to focus with the breath, we see the in-breath as it arises, stays for a little while and ceases, and the out-breath as it arises, stays for a little while and ceases. And so we do this, we have mindfulness to focus on it, and if we can do that for 5 minutes, then we're able to stop the chaos and agitation of the mind for 5 minutes. We're able to do that. Then we get strength and energy from that. And this is a way to be able to compete with or fight with the defilements of greed, aversion, and delusion. So we train in this anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing. And this is a way to develop the mind to be better or higher, and to develop it further. So we train and practice in the way that was just described, and do this every day. And in this way, the mind can get the flavor of peace, the flavor of samadhi. And we get to know the opposite of the busy, agitated mind. And we see that this is the key to success. We're able to practice. We see that it's just a little thing, but it can bring us to success. So we observe and see the arising, staying for a little while, and ceasing of the in and out breathing. And if we practice this according to the teaching, then we get peacefulness and collectedness. And this is what we call the samatha kamatana, or tranquility meditation object. So the mind's peaceful, then we teach the mind further. So the mind having become peaceful and collected, we use that peace, that peaceful mind, to contemplate these experiences, these moods that we're not able to overcome. For instance, we have something arise, or a mood in the mind that we're not able to overcome, and we investigate, well, what's the cause of that mood? What is the method to stop it or bring its cessation about? And how do we protect from that mood in the future? And so we use what we've learned, these teachings, and we see the mood or sense impression, we see the truth of it, that it's not lasting, it's impermanent. It arises, stays for a little while, and ceases. Whether it's a mood or sense object that's on the side of something that's likable or appealing, or the side that's not likable, not appealing. So we have this wisdom arise based on memory, things that we've heard before, heard Lumpur Nan, a great master, teach before, that it's of the nature to arise and cease. Before we'd get a mood or experience and we wouldn't know about this, we'd just be lost in it, lost in defilement. We would think that this mood would be with us all the time, forever, or at least for a very long time. And the mind wouldn't, we wouldn't be able to lift the mind up, or we wouldn't be able to lift the mind up quickly. But then we learn about meditation. In the beginning, we start with training the mind in peacefulness. And we're not able to be peaceful and collected all the time. Sometimes the mind is busy and agitated. Then we see these experiences arising in practice. And then we can remember the wisdom of the Dhamma teachings that we've heard. We use that to contemplate when our mind is peaceful. It's not yet true wisdom, but don't worry about that. It's things that we've heard before. We've heard that it's of the nature to arise and cease. And before we didn't know about that, but then we listen to the Dhamma and we get this knowledge that, oh, it's of the nature to arise and then cease. And that gives us sufficient strength and energy to contemplate. We see for ourselves that it's true, that this mood or experience, it's not here forever. It's also Dhamma. It arises, stays for a little while, and ceases all the same. So we see things this way a little bit at a time, and it's able to cure the suffering in our heart. Then we start to be able to answer the question of why, if we're a good person, why do we still suffer? And we see that's because the suffering we have, it has a cause and condition for its arising. So if we're able to do this one time, if we're able to do it once, able to overcome a mood like this that was bothering the mind with the method that was just explained, even if it's just a small mood or a little mood, then that the fear that when or the fear we would feel to meet that mood again, to be afraid to meet with that experience again, will become less. So before we'd be lost in that mood, and the one who knows wouldn't say to us or wouldn't tell us the way to overcome it. But then we come to open the mind and heart that's ready to learn about the Dhamma, to study the Dhamma. And the ones with knowledge, the great masters, they give us the teachings, give us advice on what's the correct path of practice. And we practice following that, then we're able to fight with these moods or compete with them in the heart. And sometimes we can win. And the fruit from that helps us going forward. So we see that it arises, stays for a little while, and ceases. And before we didn't see that, we'd be afraid that the mood would be there all the time or be there forever. But then we practice and achieve a victory, even if it's just a little mood. And then we see that what the great masters have taught, that it's true. And so when we see for ourselves that it's true, our faith gets stronger, our mind has more firm effort, or firm intent to keep training and practice, to practice further, to go from these small moods in the mind. And then we meet with big moods or big experiences or heavy moods. And so we know that these experiences or moods can cause the mind to waver or feel unstable. And so we're able to practice and overcome this small mood. And if it's a big mood, it can be difficult to overcome if we haven't developed the mind sufficiently. And so we keep practicing so that we're able to overcome, and that this is another step towards the ultimate goal, the highest goal, which is to be able to let go. So we achieve these little victories, and it gives our mind strength and energy and more faith to keep practicing more. And then we keep practicing in the right way. We don't just give up or throw out the path of practice. We keep meditating according to the great master's teachings. So we are intent to meditate, to chant. We do the morning chanting, evening chanting every day without missing it. Or we have the opportunity to practice online like we are now, the opportunity to listen to the Dhamma from those that have knowing. Like this arising and ceasing, before when I was a layperson, I didn't know about this. I had heard about it, but I didn't think it had value or wasn't useful. But then when I came to practice, met with suffering, I trained and practiced according to the teachings. So firstly, I made my mind peaceful and collected. And once my mind was peaceful, then I used what I had heard before to contemplate. So I contemplated arising and ceasing. And I saw that this was a way to overcome the problems in the mind. Before, I just didn't know what to do. When a mood arose, I didn't know what to do. So we see that this is a benefit of our meditation practice, our chanting practice, our practice of listening to Dhamma, where we have mindfulness throughout the day. We don't lose our mindfulness or discard our mindfulness. And in this way, when we come to sit in meditation, then it's easy to become peaceful. Or if we're sitting meditation and the hindrances arise, then we open our eyes, we do walking meditation, just like we've been taught. So this is the correct path to go towards our goal, which is letting go. Then we start with these small moods that we're able to let go of that, and then our fear of them reduces, and we keep practicing without ceasing. The mind becomes higher, more developed, more bright, and we're able to keep on fighting with these moods in an ongoing way. We are able to keep fighting. In the end, we're able to reach the goal of Nibbana, able to let go of the pleasure and pain of this world completely, to abandon it completely. So we do this bit by bit, a little bit at a time, one step at a time with the method as described. And then our faith and belief becomes firm in this Dhamma path, this Dhamma practice, and to do it more and more. So I hope that what I've said thus far gives you some points to consider or think about, whether you use them a lot or a little. And now at the end, I'd like to take this opportunity to tell a personal story. And these are just my own thoughts and views that arose in my own mind, my own experiences. And maybe not everyone that sees things this way or experiences things in this way. But if we look at the world of astrology, there's something called a year of conflict, or a year of bad luck, you could say, or a year of opposition, an opposite year. And this is something that you may have heard of before, or a year where you meet with various changes or difficulties, or opposition year. And when people who believe in this meet with this, then they can have some worry or lack of confidence, and that leads them to seek out refuges of various kinds, depending on the individual. So seeking out the highest refuge, this is correct. But those with little wisdom, they'll seek out other refuges. So we see that the great masters or Lumpur Nan have taught about this already. And so for myself, it was this year of 2024, I felt that I met with a lot of changes in my life, a great deal of change, different events happening, because this was the opposition year for myself, and it's a lot of changes, and they can be good changes or bad changes. There was one monk, Ajahn Pong, spent the range retreat in Germany this year. He had answered a question about this to a close student, that this opposition year, it's not always bad, but it can be good changes as well. But for Thai people, they usually understand that the opposition year, it's something bad usually. So it is true for me that this year, ever since the beginning of the year until now, throughout the Rains Retreat, there's been a great many changes in my life, great many events that I've experienced. And just like you might experience, my mind felt some wavering. So just like all of you, I tried to manage this. So if one's a lay person, one seeks out a refuge, and it might be the highest refuge, it might not, but people will seek out a refuge. And they have this mood or experience, there's this change that occurs, and it can lead the mind to feel wavering, to feel unstable. But a benefit of this training, this practice of meditation, is that one is able to overcome or cure this instability of the mind to a degree. So this is a benefit of the practice. So what were some of these changes? So they were things that needed to be fixed or needed attention, like things that happened to various people, like a friend, close disciple, or even Venerable Ajahn Anand sent a disciple who was addicted to alcohol, trying to overcome the alcoholism. And it was something that I had to take care of. And so this is something that before, this was a problem I didn't want to deal with. But Venerable Ajahn Anand gave me this person to take care of. And I remember clearly the sound of his voice saying, Gamon, do your best. And if you can't do it, then let go. So this is a teaching from Venerable Ajahn Anand, and we've heard him teach already about letting go. But we have to contemplate that there's many ways to let go. So it's not that you just let go straight away, but you do your best first as well. So with this person addicted to alcohol, if one were to just let go straight away, one could just send him off, send him somewhere else and not deal with it. That would be too easy. Because I got the instruction. And so first I took this individual to undertake the 8 precepts and wear white clothing, and he wasn't able to do that. He went to go drink again, so he couldn't stop. So then he went to do a ceremony or a cultural ceremony to determine not to drink, like a layperson style ceremony, and he wasn't able to do that either. He kept drinking, and so in the end, I took him to a rehab center for alcoholism. He was able to recover some of his mindfulness and awareness, and he did that for 3 months. But then after that 3 months, after he left, then he went to drink again. So at that point I decided I had done my best already, according to Venerable Ajahn Anand's advice. And at this point, letting go meant sending him to be home with his relatives. So this was a test for me to see this the mind wavering, not feeling stable. So this is one example. And so there, you probably have other stories from your own experience that you've met with. And this is just an example I'm giving you now to help you have motivation or strength of heart to see that this is the benefit of Dhamma practice. You have the great teacher and you have your practice. Like, there was an occasion I had the opportunity to pay respects to a venerable master in the north of Thailand. And he asked where I was staying. I said, oh, Jantaburi province. And he was quiet. All he did was nod his head. And then when I encountered these various issues, this image of this master nodding his head would come up. And I felt that I was able to overcome these issues. And Venerable Ajahn Pong was with me at the time, and we talked about how it was the opposition year, so there's probably something that I would have to do this year, something that would change. And so we see that in this example, in this story, this is overcoming the issue in the correct way. And for all of us, we recollect the teaching, the practice to bring to mind the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. We have faith in the great teacher, the great master. We recollect their loving kindness and compassion and their teachings. And this can help us to care for our minds not to waver. And so we keep training and practicing in this way. And we receive many moods and experiences and sense impressions, and we're able to deal with them safely. So I hope that this story or example has given you some strength of heart, that having met with a great master, that you don't give up or don't throw away your Dhamma practice, but you keep practicing such that you're able to overcome the moods and experiences that you meet with. And so for all of you, may you recollect the qualities of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha to care for and manage your life, and to do that safely and to do it well. And may you do that all the way until you reach your goal. And so may you all grow in blessings.